and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the Alaska World Affairs Council. Recorded on Friday, May 13th, Peter Propes presents Target America, Radical Islam, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Death of Bin Laden.
Welcome. Hello, my name is Lisa Falsko. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska World Affairs Council. And it's a pleasure to see everyone here this afternoon.
At our head table today, to my far left, is William Toyer, who you often see recording for KSKA. Today, it's our pleasure to bring him up to the head table as both a representative of the World Affairs Council and our recorder extraordinaire. And to his left, or to his right, excuse me, is Pat Yak, who is both on our board of directors and the vice president of APTI. And he will come up and introduce our speaker. Pat.
Thank you, Lisa. And today's speech will be on KSKA next Thursday at 2 and 7. So be sure to tune in, tell your friends about it. It's my delight to share a little information about our speaker today, and it's great to see so many people out on such a beautiful day like today. I was telling Peter that all of our days are like this, and he should return. Wear shorts the next time. For most of his 30-year career, Peter Probst served with the Central Intelligence Agency and the Office of the Secretary of Defense. In 2001, he left the Federal Service to establish a private consultancy with a focus on terrorism, political warfare, and infrastructure vulnerability. He draws his clientele today largely from government and the private sector, including the Fortune 100. His work at DOD primarily focused on the future terrorist threat and the development of strategies, tactics, and policy initiatives to more effectively counter it. He co-authored a major and provocative study, Terror 2000, The Future Face of Terrorism, and in the wake of the events of September 11th, gained new currency. During his 20 years with the CIA, his primary focus was on terrorism, insurgency, and political warfare. Later in his career, he worked extensively in intelligence analysis and production, preparing reports and studies for use by senior government officials, including the president. Mr. Probst is a member of the Department of Homeland Security's Partnership Program and has been invited to participate in the department's Future Terrorism Task Force. He currently serves on the Standing Committee on Global Terrorism, Political Instability, and International Crime of the American Society for Industrial Security. He's also a senior research fellow at the Center for the Advanced Study of Terrorism. Mr. Probst is a graduate of Columbia College and Columbia University, where he received a Bachelor of Arts in History and a Master of Arts in Archaeology and Anthropology. While at Columbia, he also attended the Russian Institute and the Latin American Institute. Mr. Probst, in addition, has served with the United States Air Force Intelligence Service, from which he retired with the reserve rank of Lieutenant Colonel. He's here today to talk to us about Target America, Radical Islam, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the death of Bin Laden. So please join me in welcoming Mr. Probst to Anchorage and our World Affairs Council.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and I've been enjoying your very gracious hospitality and your warm welcome and your warm weather. One of the reasons I came to Alaska is because I like to talk to groups that are engaged but perhaps not fully aware of some of the challenges facing the nation. There are probably two dates that are seared into the collective consciousness of the American people. One, of course, is 7 December 1941. The surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, and the second is 9/11. But there's also a third date, a very important date. That's 1 May 2011, when we killed Bin Laden. It was very important because it provided some element of closure. it deprived the radical Islamists of a symbol. But bin Laden was much more than a symbolic leader. He was a planner, a cunning strategist, a fundraiser par excellence, and he also was an impressive visionary for those who followed the path of radical Islam. He gained mythic status, and killing him helped destroy the picture that most folks in the area had of him, that bin Laden would be with us forever. He's not, but elements of his ideology are. We have killed the man, but what we need to do now is to kill the idea. Bin Laden sought to... Oh, thank you. Bin Laden sought to accomplish his aims through two major strategies. One was to kill Americans, or kill anyone in the Muslim world who opposed him. A second was to bleed us economically, enmesh us in conflicts and in areas, tie us down, bleed us slowly to death like he bled the Soviet Union when they invaded Afghanistan. According to Mark Zandi, it seems like bin Laden is accomplishing his aims. Mark Zandi is the chief economist at Moody's and estimates that the consequences of 9/11 cost the American economy some $205 trillion. That's trillion, it's not billion. $205 trillion. And the operation cost, according to the best estimates of the U.S. government, between $400,000 and $500,000. Now, that's an impressive return on investment. His actions caused us to reconfigure the government. It caused us to take a look at our strategies for defense of the country. We began to realize we were involved in an asymmetric conflict, and conventional military force was really not the solution. Now, I do not see al-Qaeda sinking into oblivion as a result of bin Laden's death. But rather, I see the organization likely fragmenting. There are many stresses within it. Competition, there's some very large egos involved. There are problems between the Yemeni contingent, the Egyptian contingent, Pashtun contingent. Bin Laden held these various forces together. There is no figure now, I believe, who can take its place. But al-Qaeda was self-limiting in its impact. Yes, it talked in terms of a global caliphate, span the world, and it would span the world which would operate under Sharia law. But that really doesn't speak to many of the problems of the Middle East and elsewhere. You have a demographic of youth, wherein young folks under 20 can comprise 20, 40, 50% of the population. And they go out, and there are no jobs. And worst of all from their standpoint, particularly the college graduates with their degrees in engineering and law and so forth, there is nothing for them to do but to sit in a coffee house and stew, complain about government corruption, an economy that does not work, oppression. These are the kids that bin Laden tried to attract, but had no program. After the caliphate would be established, how was he going to make jobs? How was he going to relieve the problems of the economies? And particularly, how was he going to handle corruption, which seems to be ingrained in the psyche of so much of the Arab leadership? There's another organization that has those answers and has been around for a long time and has been incredibly effective. And it's called the Muslim Brotherhood. It was founded in 1928 by Hassan al-Banna, and it serves as an umbrella group for some 70 Islamist organizations worldwide. It operates globally and has a dual-track policy. Where it is legal, it enters the fray on the political level, running candidates who are polished, who are glib, who have charisma. It's illegal in some countries. For instance, in Jordan, it's not. In Jordan, it's a powerful political party. There are other countries, such as Syria, where it has been hunted down ruthlessly. There was an incident under Assad, I believe it was in 1981, where in the city of Hama, which was an Islamist stronghold, a stronghold for the Brotherhood, there was a revolt. But Assad knew how to handle problems like this. First he shelled the town, then he carpet bombed it, then he used poison gas. An estimated 20,000 people were killed. 20,000. His son, apparently, is taking a page from his father's playbook. American-based Islamist groups often turn out to be fronts for the Brotherhood and for Hamas, which was a creation of the Brotherhood. Now, when I use the term Islamist, that's not the same as Muslim. Islamists are radical Muslims who are most interested in seizing power by whatever means necessary. It's very important to understand that throughout the Middle East, the greatest number of casualties have not been Americans, have not been coalition forces, but have been fellow Muslims. So the Muslim Brotherhood, as I say, has a two-track policy. And here in the United States, they rely on sophisticated political action operations designed to eviscerate government capabilities, to uncover and dismantle terrorist cells and support mechanisms. They capitalize on our government's failure to recognize that these political action operations can be just as damaging as a bombing or an assassination. They seek political power at all levels, often starting just on the local school board. And that's very important because the local school board helps set the curriculum. They're not only present in colleges, so through the Muslim Student Association, but they are present in grade school through high school and, of course, through college. And what they do is teachers are overworked. Teachers are tired. Teachers are underpaid. They're unappreciated. And suddenly, what appears before them is this lovely gentleman or lovely lady who says, you know, in your history curriculum, you know, there are some things that are left out. There are some things which need to be explained to the American people. The contributions that Muslims have made to the United States, some of the problems that they've received, very much like the blacks. And we would be most appreciative if you could integrate this into your lesson plans. As a matter of fact, we'll even send in a speaker. And the speaker comes, and does he speak about anything radical? Absolutely not. He speaks in terms of building bridges, of cooperation, of praying to the same God. He speaks of respect for other religions. And what is being done is preparing the ground so that people come away with a very positive view of Islam, which is great, because there are a lot of wonderful things about it. But then gradually, they have moved down a, I guess you could call it almost a slippery slope, where the injustices, which did exist or do exist, are talked about. And then, of course, the natural question is, what are we going to do about it? But that doesn't hit until they're in college. And that's a whole nother story. They use our Constitution, they use our traditions, our freedoms, and the advantages of an open society as both a sword and shield in a latest iteration of political warfare. They seek to foster malignant self-doubt, as best expressed by the question so many well-meaning people ask, why do they hate us? What did we do wrong? And the answer should be painfully obvious, but regrettably eludes too many political figures and the political pundits. The truth is, the Islamists, and let's just call them radical Islamists so there's no confusion with mainstream Islam, the radical Islamists do not hate us because of the freedoms we enjoy. They do not hate us because of our wealth. They do not hate us because we are powerful. They do not hate us because of our cause with Israel. What they mainly hate us for is that we are the major impediment to the creation of that global caliphate that bin Laden talks about, prays about, might even call it that golden city on the hill. Our actions are regarded as an impediment which must be removed by any means necessary. And sometimes those means are the political means. And this is where they're particularly expert here in this country. Their strategy is one of political warfare, to sap our strength, self-confidence, and leave us vulnerable, ultimately, to more conventional forms of aggression. Most Americans are unaware that until 9/11, the terror group Hamas received its greatest amount of funding, not from Saudi Arabia, not from the Gulf states, not from wealthy sheikhs, but from American citizens and legal resident aliens. Hamas would send into this country what I would call circuit riders, and they would come and speak at gatherings such as this. And depending on the nature of the audience, it could be relatively benign, talking in terms of Hamas's social action programs, or it could be extremely volatile. Sometimes they would be accompanied by a Hamas fighter, or terrorist, depending on your point of view, who would regale the audience with stories about Hamas attacks on Israel, the sacrifice of suicide bombers, and why they were destined to ultimately win this global conflict. They crossed the U.S. coast to coast. They spoke at universities where they were extremely effective, and where they were, where the ground was prepared by the Muslim Student Association, which was the oldest Muslim Brotherhood front in the United States. And their interest on college campuses was not only to get a message across, and that would be relatively benign, but in the question and answer period, get an idea of the students' view of the struggles in the Middle East, perhaps talk to them one-on-one, and perhaps those who are really interested in Islam, well, there would be classes on campus. And they would go to the classes, and those who came out of those classes more militant might be sent to Pakistan for religious training. And we all know where that road ends. Now, a prime mover in the efforts of the Muslim Brotherhood to subvert this country and our political process is a man named Abdanan Alamoudi. Alamoudi was the founder and executive director of the American Muslim Council, which was probably the preeminent American Muslim organization in the United States. Alamoudi was regarded by both Republicans and Democrats as the go-to guy. If you wanted to know what the American Muslim community was thinking, you spoke to Alamudi. He met at the White House with presidents of both parties. He contributed money. He contributed, I believe, it was $10,000 to Hillary Clinton at one point, which was returned. But he also contributed to Republican causes. Alamudi was an honored guest, a trusted interlocutor. And he was also the man chosen to represent the American Muslim community at the services at the National Cathedral for the victims of 9/11, all of which is very ironic. Alamudi's luck held until 2003, when he was detained at Gatwick Airport with some $340,000 of American money that had been given to him by the Libyan Intelligence Service. He was arrested when he arrived at Dulles, and he ultimately cooperated with the government. Turns out he made 10 illegal trips to Libya, among his other activities, and as part of a plea agreement, he surrendered $910,000 of money that he had been able to collect for his cause. He also acknowledged participation in a plot to kill then Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia. And his wasn't some minor support role. It was his job to recruit the assassins. This is a man who met with American presidents, photographed with their families, who had a close relationship with senators and congressmen on the Hill, who was personable, who was glib, who was warm, and who was lethal. The ultimate end to Mr. Alamudi is he's serving 23-year sentence in a federal penitentiary. But people like Alamudi continue to do their work. And if they are accused by somebody such as myself, they immediately turn to what is called legal terrorism. They sue. They've got deep pockets. People like me don't. So a lot of people learn to keep their mouths shut. Except there is a counter, and the counter is discovery motions. And a lot of those lawsuits have been abandoned because the groups realized that they had more to lose if ever they faced, under oath, the questions that were going to be asked. In 2007, in a courtroom in Dallas, a drama played out of great importance. It was the trial of the Holy Land Foundation. The Holy Land Foundation was very large, very powerful, and its job was to collect funds for Hamas. There, as I recall, there were five key members who were put on trial. First trial was a hung jury. The second trial, they were found guilty. And they received sentences of something between 15 and 65 years. But particularly telling were the documents the government released in relation to the Holy Land Foundation, which was a creation of the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Muslim Brotherhood's strategy in this country. Their authenticity was never disputed at the trial by the defendants, who were the Holy Land, executive officers. The government charged that these papers revealed that for some 40 years, the Brotherhood has been carrying out an aggressive campaign in the United States of political action using fronts such as charities, such as political action groups. They insinuated themselves into the American fabric. They lived like you or me. Nice lawns, beautiful lawns, members of the garden club, PTA, the whole nine yards. But lest you think that the Muslim Brotherhood is essentially a benign organization. You only need to know their credo. And their credo is, Allah is our objective, the Prophet is our teacher, Quran is our law, jihad is our way, and dying in the service of Allah is our highest hope. This is not a benign interpretation of jihad. This is holy war. And the Brotherhood leads it using multiple mechanisms. They've been in this country, as the government charged, for some 40 years. Now, one of the most important documents the government entered into evidence is it was a 1991 memorandum, and it was titled On the General Strategic Goals for the Group in North America, and it was written by a senior Muslim Brotherhood official. The document lays out the role of the brothers in the United States. It starts off, the process of settlement, and that's referencing the United States, is a civilization jihadist process, with all that means. The brothers must understand that their work in America is a kind of grand jihad in eliminating and destroying the Western civilization from within and sabotaging the miserable house by their hand and the hands of the believers so that it is eliminated and God's religion is made victorious over all other religions. Without this level of understanding, we are not up to the challenge, and we have not prepared ourselves for jihad yet. It is a Muslim's destiny to perform jihad and work wherever he is, wherever he lands, until the final hour comes. And there is no escape from that destiny except for those who choose to shirk. There is no ambiguity in the aims of the group, nor any effort to dignify their definition of jihad, as so many members of these Muslim Brotherhood fronts claim. This is not an inner existential struggle to find a better way to resist temptation and so forth. Muslim Brotherhood fronts established in the U.S. have included the United Association for Studies and Research, which was set up to function as a think tank. Political strategy. There was the Islamic Association for Palestine, which focused on propaganda. And then, of course, political action. And then the Occupied Lands Fund, which later became the Holy Land Foundation. And their role was to gather money for the cause. The government also entered into evidence information pertaining to a 1993 clandestine meeting held in Philadelphia. There, Omar Ahmed, the then president of the Islamic Association of Palestine, emphasized the need to strengthen radical Islamist influence and the strategies they should use. The IAP has been named by the government as both a Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas front. Now, Omar Ahmed was captured on FBI surveillance tape explaining that the IAP could not, for political reasons, admit support for Hamas. And in his discussions, he talked about how the Hamas agenda could be cloaked and advanced. He stated that, and this is a quote, those who stay in America should be open to society without melting. And I think that means, you know, sort of the melting pot, without being fully integrated. That you keep the mosques open so anyone can come in. So anyone can come in and can learn about Islam. If you choose to live here, you have a responsibility to deliver the message of Islam. That's a benign statement. It truly is. Why not? But then he goes on to say, Islam isn't in America to be equal to any other faiths, but to become dominant. The Quran, the Muslim book of scripture, should be the highest authority in America, and Islam, the only accepted religion on earth. This is a theocratic state on a global platform. Talks about suicide bombers. Fighting for freedom, fighting for Islam is not suicide. They kill themselves for Islam. Suicide bombers are an accepted and actually glorified weapon with a fast track to heaven. According to an article by Niyad Awad, the IAP leadership resigned itself to establish a new organization called the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE. They wanted to create a new mass organization that would not be defined by the Palestinian struggle, but rather had a broader mission. It would project an image of moderation and accommodation, and it would define itself as the premier Muslim American organization dedicated to combating anti-Muslim discrimination nationwide. An article published by CAIR, C-A-I-R, Council for American Islamic Relations, and cited in press accounts, note that the North American Islamic Trust, an unindicted co-conspirator in the Holy Land trial, owns approximately 27% of the mosques, some 12,000 of them, here in the United States. This provides the brothers a bully pulpit and a tool for indoctrination and recruitment. Many of the mosques they do not own are currently under siege. Hostile takeovers. In 1999, in testimony before a State Department forum, Sheikh Mohammed Kabani, a highly respected Sufi leader with a following of truly millions of people, stated that some 80% of the mosques, in his opinion, are controlled by radicals. And this analysis was borne out by other analysts at think tanks here in the United States and elsewhere. As a result of his candor, Sheikh Kabani was subjected to a campaign of harassments and threats. I was actually asked to meet with him to talk, you know, security, personal security, because he feared for his life. Just as the Soviets, through the Comintern and similar mechanisms, mounted more than a 50-year campaign of subversion, covert action, and deception and misinformation, the radical Islamists, through the Muslim Brotherhood, like the communists, have continued this strategy. They, in my opinion, have borrowed from the playbook of the Communist Party. They talk on all levels. They tell people what they believe will be most acceptable. And then they insinuate their message, whether it's in a small group meeting in a small town, or whether it's inside government, where there are any number of Muslim Brotherhood followers. What we are facing is a sophisticated and calculated campaign to shape public perception, define a new political reality. What we have is political correctness run amok. To call somebody a radical Islamist, even if you have proof in hand, will bring down a deluge of criticism, of vile interpretations of your action, that you have Islamophobia, that you hate all Muslims. I don't know, how much time do I have? Because I'd like to tell you a story. Okay. I had a close friend. His name was Khalid Duran, a Muslim scholar, spoke seven languages, brilliant man. But Khalid Duran had one fatal flaw. He truly wanted to build bridges between the great religions. So Khalid wrote a book called Islam for Jews to explain what Islam was all about. Before the book was even published, he began to receive threats. And what happened after the book was published was people from organizations, and I'm given to understand this organization who led the charge was CARE, I don't know whether that's true or not. I don't have proof, but the people who told me are knowledgeable. These representatives from the Islamist organizations went to his clients. He was a translator. And they told him, you know, are you sure you want to be associated with Khalid Duran? You know, he's anti-Muslim. And more than that, you know, if you, you know, continue that association, we have to regard you as a partner. And we don't want to do that because we like you guys. Khalid lost contracts right and left. But finally, you know, the U.S. government stepped in and offered him a contract to translate textbooks in Pakistan. Now, here's a guy with his background going to Pakistan. And this was after a fatwa had been issued calling for his death. Three or four members of one of these Muslim Brotherhood fronts toward the Middle East, looking for an accommodating imam. And they found one in Jordan named Abu Zant, who not only heads a very strong political party, the political front for the Brotherhood, but also as an imam has a great following. And they talked to Abu Zant, and Abu Zant agreed. He wrote out a fatwa, and it read, Khalid Duran's blood may be spilled. This is the language that's normally used. This created something of a furor. But there was some question about it, some lack of clarity. So he issued a second fatwa, clarifying the point. He was extremely accommodating. The people who went and toured the Middle East and spoke to Abu Zant and enlisted his assistance, I would say they were engaged in solicitation for murder. I'm no lawyer. I don't know what the charges might be. But in my book, that's the least of their crimes. Khalid Duran was living in this country. He was on the road to citizenship. But he was left to hang out and dry. I mean, hang out and wave in the breeze. In Pakistan, which was a pretty rough situation for him, as you may well imagine, he suffered a heart attack, had to be evacuated to Germany for medical treatment, and it affected his speaking ability. He was a magnificent speaker with a mellifluous voice. He couldn't speak anymore to get fees. He couldn't do translations anymore because people were afraid to hire him. This is political warfare. This is intimidation. And this is the sort of thing that goes on in this country on a daily basis. We are facing a sophisticated and calculated campaign to shape public perception. And the Brotherhood, in its various forms and guises, will continue to mount aggressive operations to achieve the ultimate Islamization of America and the imposition of Sharia law. The government's failure to mount an effective and coordinated response to this is one of the greatest failings. Yes, we have very sophisticated programs in terms of defending against bombs or guns or assassination or carnage, but this is different. What we are engaged in is not a war on terrorism, but rather a protracted conflict in which our war on terror is but one component. This is a war of ideas and competing ideologies. It is political warfare in the broadest sense. It is a conflict that will last generations. Our adversaries take the long view, whereas we continue to plan from budget cycle to budget cycle. The radical Islamists demonstrate a sense of grand strategy. They play chess while we play checkers. This is not a game for impatient people. This is a long war, and not, as I say, war in the conventional sense. And how we deploy our resources, How we meet the challenge will ultimately determine the winners and the losers and the price paid by each. Thank you.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Peter Propes from the International Institute for Counterterrorism. For most of his 30-year career, Peter Propes served with the Central Intelligence Agency and the Office of the Secretary of Defense. He was recorded speaking at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage on May 13th. Following his talk entitled Target America, Radical Islam, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Death of Bin Laden, Mr. Propes responded to questions from audience members.
I guess from your talk, I should be fearful that someone's going to try and make me a Muslim. And you gloss over the injustices that have been committed, like our wars against Middle Eastern countries, our theft of their resources, our support of the oppressive dictators. You worked for the CIA, which has committed numerous terrorist acts. We could go through a list if you'd like, but I'm sure you already know those. Now you work for a company that is essentially profiting off of the war on terror. And shouldn't I be more fearful of someone like you than a Muslim caliphate when you're the one who's helping bleed this economy dry?
No. Well, first of all, I haven't bombed anybody. I haven't... Wait. No, you had yours say. Now give me mine. I haven't set off any IEDs. I haven't sawed off the heads of journalists, such as what happened to Daniel Pearl. I haven't attacked school children. If you think, and you're trying to equate, you're trying to create a moral equivalence between, let's say, the war in Afghanistan, which was the base from which the attack on the United States was launched. We have a right to self-defense. No, wait, you let me finish. We have a right to self-defense, and we exercise that right. And we will continue to do that. And if your next statement is, we shot an unarmed man, meaning Bin Laden, I think that explains your ideology and from where you're coming.
I have a question on the killing of Bin Laden. We keep hearing from the news media and even the administration itself of all the treasure of information that we received. Shouldn't there be more restraint on transparency in this case? You know, they're talking about a lot of detail. There's obviously a lot of information gained on who he was communicating with and a lot of other information. I'd like to hear your views on the, shouldn't there be more transparency coming from the administration and news media on all that information that we've gained?
Well, if it's transparency and we provide the information, that's providing warning to our adversaries as to what we know, as well as what we may not know. I would much prefer if there was less transparency. I would have preferred if the killing of Bin Laden had been carried out in such a way that nobody would know who actually did it. Because he has rivals in Al-Qaeda. He has problems in terms of the ISI, who I personally believe provided him sanctuary in Pakistan for at least 5 years, as they did with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the architect of the 9/11 attack. It's my personal opinion, and it's opinion. I can't produce facts to tell you that, to back it up, but it's my personal opinion that Al-Qaeda and many of these organizations, including Lashkar-e-Taiba, the Muslim organization that attacked the hotels in Mumbai, I believe this was all ISI. ISI used to be very open in its support of Islamist causes, and they created numerous terrorist groups to harass India. But these terrorist groups moved beyond that. And Lashkar-e-Taiba now has a worldwide presence, including here in the United States. We owe a lot of our problems to the Pakistani intelligence service and those who serve their cause.
Thank you for coming today. We really appreciate your bold statements, at least I do. The President of the United States has been reluctant to use the word radical Islam. We have a war on radical Islam. He refuses to use words like we're going to win. He throws Mubarak under the bus while allowing other dictators to kind of roam and have their way. Israel right now, and at least in my 49 years here on Earth, is a little nervous about whether or not the President of the United States is with them, or is he with Islam. There, and I could go on, there's people in the administration who have, at least it appears, they have great sympathy towards the radical Islam. What do you make out from this attitude and his unwillingness to share your comments?
I think the rationale between, in terms of not using the term jihad or holy war is that many people believe it would be offensive to mainstream Muslims here in the United States. The funny thing is that the Islamists, the radical Islamists, the terrorists, use it all the time. If you cannot define the enemy, if you cannot name the enemy, how the heck can you fight him? You need to be able to call a spade a spade. When you start tinkering with vocabulary like that, words have power. Words set you on a thought process. And words can often, either by omission or commission, change the policy of a nation. This, to me, is political warfare. If the Islamists, the radical Islamists, can be engaged in a grand jihad, you heard the quote I gave you, why can't we say it? There have been sensitivity documents in the U.S. government talking about, you know, you don't use jihad, all this stuff. This is political correctness run amok. This is letting our adversaries set the vocabulary which will ultimately define our policies.
Thank you. My question, I guess I'm thinking of your friend that had the heart attack as well as someone who is a bridge builder, and I'd like to think that some of us are bridge builders, but my concern is that how do we know how to do that? Recently, I guess it's been a couple of years, at APU there was a class that was actually funded by Carr Gottstein and the Catholic theological chair that set up an engaging Muslims program. We met with Muslims in our community, we talked to them. So we're in some of this process you're talking about, and my concern is, I understand what the Muslim Brotherhood is now, but how do we, as just ordinary people, know when we're being taken advantage by jihadists or being indoctrinated by them, or when we're dealing with people whom we may want to build bridges with?
I think the most important thing is to become engaged, is to read as much as you can, get diverse points of view, watch Al Jazeera, know the enemy. Know the enemy, know their tactics and strategies, and then you'll begin to pick it out. Hey, this suddenly took a rather strange turn. I was following that guy's line of reasoning, and then all of a sudden, it went off this way. That's strange. You can also check. Google is a wonderful tool in terms of past statements that have been made. We also have a big problem with the Wahhabis. And that's the sect in Saudi Arabia. Very fundamentalist. Bin Laden grew out of that. And in essence, they fund chairs. They fund departments at our universities. And of course, if they're funding a chair or a study center, they get to pick the professors. And being a professor is a very thankless job. And it's usually underpaid. So if you're teaching a bunch of students and your salary and the endowment is dependent on Saudi Arabian Wahhabis, you begin to self-censor. You have a family to take care of. You have kids who need to go to college. It's subtle. It's dangerous. It's political warfare.
Hi, I'm glad that you were here and we got the chance to hear your statements. But I am very fearful of, do you think that there's ever a time that we can all live in one world in peace? And I see people shaking their heads, and that makes me very afraid. If we can't find a central ground for Islam, Jews, everybody, we have no future. Now, we can't have this very idealistic, putting everybody in one box. If you're Muslim, you're this. I'm sorry, I come from the East Coast where we had the Salem witch trials. We have to find an intelligent way to communicate with each other and to have ideas that we can share in an intelligent way and not an emotional way. And that's the problem with words like jihadist and those words. Those are hot words. And if you have a charismatic leader and they throw those words around, there's trouble. Thank you so much.
Okay, well, first of all, I'm not sure if we were referring to the some of the trials in New York, like the trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's nephew, who was responsible in large part for the first World Trade Center bombing. I mean, people said from the radical Islamist community that these were Salem witch trials. They weren't. We had them cold. And the evidence proved that, and now he's in a maximum security prison. What we have to be careful of is defining Muslim Americans either as our adversaries or potential enemies. We have to try as best to integrate them into our communities. But frankly, most of them are afraid. And I talk to them all the time. They don't want problems. They don't want to end up like Khalid Duran. They drop out of the mosque, try to find a more moderate mosque, and they're often unsuccessful. The radical Islamists in this country are the organized minority. And yes, jihadists, not our term, their term, is an inflammatory word. And so is fascist. And so is communist. And so is capitalist pig. But these have been the vocabularies of the times. You say we have to find the common ground. And yes, we have to keep trying. But, and this may sound very cynical, but I think in a way peace, in the long-term perspective, is an anomaly. I regard peace as that interval between wars, when people and countries are in essence too tired to fight. But people are very resilient, and they reconstruct their society, rebuild their cities, and old quarrels and old enmities continue to fester until they're manifested by violence. My view is the human animal is perhaps the most dangerous animal on earth. And what we hope to do, and I hope this, you know, young lady is able to do it, is channel these forms of aggression into constructive pathways.
Yeah, this perhaps is a bit of a comment also, but I'm not sure you give the American citizen enough credit in terms of understanding what's going on in his or her life and the surrounding community. And I'm concerned that some of your talk will get people out on a sort of Muslim witch hunt. And that really concerns me that is a consequence of the language that you use.
Well, this is why I try to differentiate between the radical Islamists and mainstream Islam. I mean, this is true. I mean, let's think in terms of Christianity. Mainstream Christians are great, but there are certain organizations that use the name Christian or use Christian ideologies to justify lynchings and murder and terrorism. Jewish faith, the same thing. There's the Jewish Defense League, which is a terrorist organization. It's not very powerful, but it is there. Religions have fringe elements, and those fringe elements are most dangerous, not to the people they target, but to the mainstream followers of that particular faith. In terms of Christianity, I was thinking of the Christian Identity Movement, which is not Christian, it uses the trappings, but highly dangerous. So it's up to the leaders of these religions to speak up and to be the first, to be the first to call the radicals a menace to the faith and to the country and to their fellow citizens of all faiths.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Peter Propes from the International Institute of Counterterrorism. He responded to questions from audience members following his talk entitled Target America, Radical Islam, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Death of Bin Laden, which was recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage on May 13, 2011. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.